Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Film, a podcast series on the New Books Network. I am your host, Joel Cherney. In September 1941, a group of isolationist senators held hearings to criticize what they considered to be a push towards war from Jewish Hollywood producers. Chris Yogersts joins me to discuss his book, Hollywood Hates Hitler, Jew-baiting, Anti-Nazism, and the Senate Investigation into Warmongering in Motion Pictures. The book was published in 2020 by the University Press of Mississippi. In addition to reviewing the actual hearings, we also talk about the America First movement during this period, where men like Charles Lindbergh fought against U.S. involvement in the European War. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Chris Yogersts. Welcome to the podcast, Chris.
Thank you for having me.
So we're talking about your book, Hollywood Hates Hitler, Jew-baiting, Anti-Nazism, and the Senate Investigation into Warmongering in Motion Pictures. That's a long title.
But it is. It was a difficult book to title, for sure.
But it actually does what it means, because it literally tells the entire story, what the book's about. We don't even need to talk. People just don't know. No, I'm kidding.
There you go. That was easy.
So one of the things you even mentioned in the introduction, but I think it's worth mentioning also here, is the concept of xenophobia. And while we are obviously in a particular time period where xenophobia in certain aspects seems to be rampant, it's nothing new. Obviously, we can talk about immigration for over the years and going back as many years as when people from other countries first started coming over here, even before there was a country. But I think there's no question that these days there's enough of a comparison that it's worth discussing as part of how your book talks about that aspect of pre-World War II. We can even talk about things like, even as examples, Philip Roth's Plot Against America and the HBO miniseries. People who don't necessarily know who these characters are, the people we're going to be talking about, maybe they're starting to hear a little bit more about some of them, and this your book definitely will help give it better context.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm glad you mentioned Plot Against America, because that's a really great series. And I was pleasantly surprised when I was watching it that a lot of the people that are involved in this investigation, or a few of them anyway, are mentioned kind of as asides, certain senators and things like that that are mentioned, which made me believe that the people who put together that show really did their research, that even these side comments that characters are making, they're using so much real history. And a big part of that, I mean, it's interesting how watching that series after researching this book, that the more I learned about Lindbergh, the more I realized how plausible that series and book actually was. Like, it's very similar to something like Man in the High Castle, you know, where you have this, you know, a couple little things in history could have shifted, and all of a sudden we could be looking at a very different reality. And the 1930s was, you mentioned the xenophobia. I mean, there's the polarization and xenophobia in the 30s that is so much like today. And one of the things that drew me to this project was researching Hollywood in the 30s and seeing how different it was than I had thought it might have been. We hear, you know, I grew up, my grandparents, part of the greatest generation, my grandparents in World War II, and you hear about all of this, you know, the country coming together, and you have all of these stories. But before, you know, literally leading up to Pearl Harbor, that was not the case. There was so much polarization, there was so much xenophobia, and this investigation, even though it's largely been overshadowed by history, is a perfect culmination of all of these emotions and fears that were going on after the Depression and leading up to World War II.
And of course, as we'll talk about, the investigation itself took place, the hearings took place in September of 1941, so we're literally only a few months away from Pearl Harbor. And you sort of wonder, had Pearl Harbor not happened in December, could there have been major changes? Obviously, Roosevelt had just been reelected, so that wasn't right. going to change, at least immediately, but hopefully. But there's no question that the time period, it, you know, you as you say, things happen and slight differences and things could have been completely the other way. Obviously, had, you know, England not been able to withstand Germany's work against them after Dunkirk, there was another situation that could have changed things. So now your background, you actually are teaching at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. You also, and of course your main topic or your main interest is communications, but arts and humanities. And then of course, this is not your first Hollywood book. Your first book was about Warner Brothers, From the Headlines to Hollywood, The Birth and Boom of Warner Brothers. Where did that book come from?
That book I actually built out of my dissertation.
Pretty normal.
Right.
But
right,
that's
pretty
good.
Standard. I wanted to, you know, one of the things, it was one of these deals where I loved researching Warner Brothers and reading about Warner Brothers. And you always hear this, like, Warner Brothers ripped from the headlines. But no one's ever really taken a deep dive into, like, how they did that for a lengthy period of time. So I started that with my dissertation and expanded it into the book. And actually, how I came to the Hollywood Hates Hitler book was part of my first book research. I came across Harry Warner's testimony in the investigation, and I thought it was fascinating. I thought it was a perfect, it's perfect Harry Warner. And it kind of sat for a little while, and I was trying to do more Warner Brothers research, and I stumbled upon a folder at the Cal State Northridge at their archive. And I stumbled upon a folder of the press coverage of the investigation. And when I looked at how widespread and how far syndicated across the country the columns were about this investigation, I started to wonder if there was a book here, if this was something that was a bigger deal than I might've thought it was. And again, this is why I talk about in my last chapter, why this might have been overshadowed by history, but it's also kind of obvious, you know, Pearl Harbor happens, World War II happens, and everything changes. But a big part of my interest is Warner Brothers, and I'm actually still researching Warner Brothers stuff for another book. But that's really what got me to this book, was Harry Warner's testimony, as well as Warner Brothers' anti-Nazi movies.
One of the people you mentioned in your acknowledgments, and we were talking before we started recording, of various other books and people who either I've interviewed or you've talked about that are interest to me, but Vonda Kreft, mm-hmm. I interviewed her quite a while ago about her book about Fox, the Fox studio.
It's a great book.
These early studio studies are so interesting for film history because it is so much of the time periods. What comes out of what those time periods were like is so important. And sometimes when we talk about filmmaking and films themselves, understanding what the time periods are like is so important to what the studios ended up doing.
Definitely. I think that's one of the biggest advantages that film history and film historians have, is that, I mean, in academia, there's a lot of discussion on, you know, the field had its historic turn, and you know, it's kind of all been written. But those of us that are still diving around into the archives, it doesn't take long to realize there are a lot of stories yet to tell, and a lot of context that needs to be I mean, you know, you mentioned Vanda's book, which is a great book. And, you know, that's one, you know, who knew we needed, you know, an 800-page book about William Fox, but you go through it and you learn so much about not just Fox, but the early, you know, political ramifications of film and the struggles that exhibitors had and all of the, how he helped take down Edison and all this kind of stuff that opens the door for everything else that comes after. And that's part of what I was doing here. And I think that's one of the things that is very important for film historians today. And I think the biggest, I guess not really a hurdle, it's just a responsibility maybe to provide historical context. And because like you said, these films, as well as the studios, are products of their time. You know, they are working within and responding to the era in which they're living.
Right. I've talked to people about things like censorship and changes like that. And obviously, one of the things we consistently know about Hollywood is they make changes based on the time, but so that they can avoid having changes made to them. They adjust accordingly. And there's never been a countrywide censorship system for films because Hollywood will change before they get around to doing that. Mm-hmm. And so understanding that is important. Let's talk a little bit about going into the beginning of the book, where obviously we've touched on it a little bit, but let's talk more about this pre-World War II period going back into the 30s and 40s, particularly when people like Lindbergh suddenly moved away from what he was known for originally as an airplane pilot into politics and other issues. Obviously, as you point out, the post-World War I period was definitely one where many people just felt like the idea of getting involved in another war was just not something they wanted to do. But this was even prior to Hitler's major appearance. There were, you know, he had taken power in 1933 and then builds up. But even during this early period, before Nazism is really on the front page, before the war actually starts in Europe, some of these folks are already out there talking and making issues related to isolationism. And one of the things, as you point out, comes out is anti-Semitism rears its ugly head pretty quickly. Who was Charles Coughlin? Because I think he's somebody that people hear the name, maybe they know it basically, but I think he's an important figure that people should not forget who he was.
Definitely, yeah. Charles Coughlin was a radio preacher. And
he was Catholic.
Yes, he was.
He was actually father.
Father Charles. Yeah, Father Coughlin. You're right. And he had a pretty, you know, he rose to prominence for very different reasons that he became, you know, that then he was known in later into the 30s, into the early 40s. He was eventually, you know, he rose for just being this accessible orator, and it was eventually booted off of radio because he became so anti-Semitic and so hateful and so angry. And it's interesting. Every fall in my pop culture class, I teach A Face in the Crowd and Andy Griffith, the great film about, you know, this radio personality goes into television and then the power kind of corrupts him. And very similar thing with Coughlin, and he all, you know, he was very much, by the time we're leading up to the investigation, he and people like him were, you know, it was perfect bait. I mean, that's why I say Jew baiting in the title, because that's what a lot of people would say in the press. Gerald Nye, one of the primary senators involved in the investigation, actually used that term as well, and that's what was, you know, the xenophobia was really peaking by the late 30s. And one of the things that is interesting about this time period, and Coughlin is a great example of this, as is like Huey Long down south and Lindbergh, of course, and a lot of the America First movement, is that once Hollywood started to be a little bit more open about their anti-Nazi feelings, anybody that harbored any kind of xenophobia or anti-Jewish sentiment doubled down on that as well. So one of the big things was in Europe, of course, Kristallnacht happens. and you have the Nazis raiding Jewish-owned businesses and homes and things like that. And all of a sudden, this stuff is out in the wide, out in the open for everybody, even those who weren't paying attention to it. And of course, for long before that, the Hollywood moguls and a lot of people in Hollywood that had relatives in Europe still were well aware of what was going on and what was coming. This is why we had, you know, the Hollywood Anti-Nazi League, which is has a very interesting history. You have a lot of anti-Nazi espionage going on in Los Angeles. There's been some books written about that that are wonderful. Hitler in Los Angeles by Steve Ross and Hollywood Spies by Laura Rosenzweig both detail what was going on with Leon Lewis, who was a LA lawyer, and Mendel Silberberg, who was a lawyer for MGM, as well as a lot of other big shots in Hollywood, helped organize funding for anti-Nazi espionage. So long before the investigation starts, a lot of people in Hollywood, I shouldn't overgeneralize, but a lot of powerful people in Hollywood were very aware of the growing domestic threat of fascism. So by the time the investigation starts and the senators are acting like this is kind of a new thing they need to squash, the a lot of the Hollywood moguls have been battling this for many, many years, including one of the my favorite stories is Carl Laemmle. Literally the last years of his life, he was getting as many people as he could out of Europe, and the government actually shut him down, said, you finance too many people. So he's then writing letters and other people in Los Angeles trying to get them to get people, allow people into the refugees into their homes. So this is, you know, by 38, when Kristallnacht happens, this is, in Hollywood anyway, this, the battle of against fascism, is already well underway.
And so people like Coughlin and others were people who, as you point out in the book, you know, the introduction, you talk a little bit about Coughlin, about how he started as reasonably, you know, he was very fiery and everything, and people listened to him. But then as time went on, he got more and more out there, anti-Semitic, and eventually, as you point out, get pulled off the air completely because of it. But it was a definite example of how in public, normal conversation and news and other ways, these kinds of people were able to get out there and talk a little bit, talk about these issues. And then, of course, the other major figure from this period that, and we were talking about Plot Against America, but it's important, is Lindbergh. We know Lindbergh, obviously, originally from his flight, solo flight to over the Atlantic, which he won a, you know, medals for and everything, and it was incredibly, it was an unbelievable achievement. And then, of course, unfortunately, he went through the issue with he and his wife's child being kidnapped and killed, which got him, continued his being well known among the public.
Right.
But one of the things that isn't always known or doesn't usually get discussed when we talk about Lindbergh is his isolationism and his desire to keep the United States not only out of the war, but also the belief that what's going on in Germany is a good thing and something that deserves praise, even as opposed to obviously many people who believe that the United States would eventually get involved. Where does Lindbergh start in this whole process of the America First movement?
Yeah, that's a really important thing to bring up. And that's why I start the book talking about really two major figures that are really polar opposite by the 1930s, which is Lindbergh, of course, and Alvin York, which I've already made the great Warner Brothers film of Sergeant York.
Right. When you hear of Sergeant York, that's who we're talking about.
Right. And he you know, was a staunch anti-war, right? He didn't, until the Warner Brothers film, he didn't want to profit. He didn't want anybody using his story for entertainment and this kind of thing. But by the late 1930s, mid-late 1930s, he changed his tune. And it's not necessarily that he became pro-war, but that's one of the things that's probably important to point out is that there was the, you know, in the book, I'm careful not to say like pro-war, anti-war. It's more like the isolationism and the interventionism. And part of the interventionist mindset was not necessarily to jump into another war, because like you said, you know, a lot of people were still miffed about World War One. They didn't want to get pulled into another war. And one of the big, one of the big pieces of legislation that was very controversial was FDR's Lend-Lease bill that he signed. And what this did is it effectively sent everything except for troops over to Britain to help them defend themselves from the Nazis. So even into the investigation, I mean, even at one point they asked, you know, the senators asked Harry Warner, you know, do you want us to go to war? And he says, no. And this is in, you know, September of 41. He says, we just need to help them however we can. So that's kind of where York was, that we should help, but maybe not get into war. But then you have Lindbergh, along with the America First movement, who is very much isolationist. Yeah. And when you, which on its head, or on its surface, sounds, I mean, kind of understandable post-World War One. You don't want to get drawn into another conflict. You don't want to have that kind of havoc wreaked on the economy and all this kind of stuff. But when you go past that and you start looking at their speeches and you listen to the rhetoric, you start to notice different motives. And a lot has been written in recent years about the America First movement being co-opted by pro-Nazi organizations and being friendly with the German-American Bund and the Silver Shirts and these kinds of groups. And when you look at the speeches from Lindbergh, when you get into 40 and 41, and as well as other people, part of the America First movement, it gets very xenophobic. And there's a lot of talk about, you know, we are for Americans only, or, you know, they almost say, you know, 100% American, which has, you know, lots of strings attached. And Lindbergh had actually, where a lot of the anti-Semitism proof comes from, and I've seen books on Lindbergh where authors are desperately trying to say he wasn't anti-Semitic, but he said in a speech that the biggest threat to the United States is the Jewish controlled media, movies and media. So at that point, the cat was kind of out of the bag.
So basically he thought the media was a bigger threat than the banks and the finances, like a lot of anti-Semites tend to push.
Right. I mean, and of course, with a lot of the talk through the America First movement, they mentioned that. But once you get, I think probably after 1939, once Hollywood starts making anti-Nazi movies, then that's when they really start to go after Hollywood, because it's much higher profile, of course. And, and there were some issues there where, I mean, you mentioned censorship earlier, and there were strictures in the production code that talked about not ridiculing other countries and religions and things like that. So that's why the studios for a long time were very careful not to say Nazi or Germany or Jewish in movies. You know, we have, you know, movies like Black Legion and They Won't Forget that are very careful to veil this kind of stuff very cleverly. But by 39, of course, and Confessions of a Nazi Spy, then that's kind of the watershed moment. And other people have written about that as soon as Warner Brothers goes all in with that film, then other studios do as well.
And of course, we mentioned Plot Against America at the beginning. Famously, in both the book and the movie, Charles Lindbergh becomes president of the United States, and that's where that starts off. And it's that aspect where the concept of being America First and anti-war with the Germans becomes the linchpin of that storyline, and it all comes from these kind of situations. So what kind of, you mentioned this, that Hollywood begins to do anti-Nazi films in the late 30s. Confessions of a Nazi Spy is the one you mentioned. Was there some decision, I mean, in reading about the background of these films, obviously they were being made purposely to point out the anti-Nazi aspect of them, but what made the decision that they were going to start making these kind of films?
Well, I think the biggest thing, like I said, a lot of the studios had to be careful to avoid censorship issues and pushback. But I think the biggest thing, what made it easy for Warner Brothers, for sure, for Confessions of a Nazi Spy, is that are at that point for decades, just about, since 1918, had been ripping from the headlines. They had been making movies based on news. And Confession of a Nazi Spy is based on the very real news story of Leon Theroux outing this spy ring. I believe it was in New York. But anyway, you know, and then the trial of these, of, you know, the espionage trial and all this kind of stuff. So it was all in the news. It was all out there, and it was for the taking. So they weren't just, you know, nobody could really argue that, oh, this is some kind of conspiratorial, you're making them out, you know, making this look bigger, like a bigger deal than it is. This was, no, this was a real thing. And Leon Theroux actually was told, you know, not to, to spill the beans to the press on a lot of this. And he said, people need to know what's going on. And he did anyway. And so that's actually one of the things that comes up in Harry Warner's defense, is that, hey, this was news and we were just making movies about news. So that was a really easy way to do it and get that first one out of the way. But then of course, after that, when actually really a lot of the other movies after that are still based on books. Another movie that comes up quite a few times in the investigation is The Mortal Storm, the Frank Borzage film. And that's another one that was based on a book. And that's one of the things that even before the investigation starts, the Hollywood's counsel was Wendell Willkie, who was a presidential candidate in 1940. And he was very much of an activist mindset. And he jumped at the opportunity to defend Hollywood. And he said to the press, you need to, you know, if you're going to investigate the movies, maybe also start investigating the books and publishers and authors that these movies are based on, because it's not just the movies.
And of course, one of the other films that came out of this, that one of these that you mentioned, and I think probably is even more well known than some of the other ones you mentioned, is Chaplin's The Great Dictator, mm-hmm. which at the time, this was already post, the war had already started in Europe, and of course, Charles Chaplin being British, I'm sure that did not necessarily make him any less of a target for these kind of complaints about.
Right. Yeah. And that movie comes up a lot in this as well, but it's interesting how it does, because they mention Chaplin, they mention the Great Dictator, and they always mention how Chaplin was, you know, a great artist. And they'll, you know, because they obviously knew he was probably one of the most popular celebrities on the planet. But then they would kind of backtrack that, and they would talk about, yeah, he's a great artist, but he's not American, right? No, he wasn't born here. So during the investigation, they always make references like that to somebody. And then they're always quick to point out, but he's not, effectively what they're saying, he's not one of us though, right? You know, he's not 100% American. He's from elsewhere. But even some of the one of the people who did testify early on was Jimmy Fidler, who was a syndicated columnist and radio critic, very much a thorn in the side of Hollywood. I didn't know much about him before diving into this book, but I got the clear sense that nobody in Hollywood liked this guy. And actually, during his testimony, he points out The Great Dictator, and he says it's a film that should never have been made. He completely hated it. But a lot of the other people who talk about it, even the senators who bring it up, tend to see why it's appreciated, but they then still quickly finger it as propaganda and that it's still, you know, dangerous.
Of course, propaganda tends to be whatever it's called that when it's something you don't agree with, it becomes propaganda.
Right, and that's pointed out in the investigation too. Another person who was subpoenaed was John Flynn. And in the beginning, he talks about, you know, not really having an issue with propaganda because he's written some of it himself. So they get him on that right away. They're like, well, you just don't like propaganda that you disagree with.
Right. So as we now, we that's basically the lines have been drawn at this point. And while the anti-Semitism is there, it's not automatically the biggest part of some of these early aspects, even though some of the folks involved were clearly anti-Semitic. But what are the groups that begin to actually start to push back against what Hollywood's doing and eventually leads to this Senate investigation?
Yeah, so the way that I, you know, trying to piece this all together for the book, I saw a couple different things. So there's Senator Gerald Nye, from South Dakota, who was a part of the America First movement, increasingly anti-Hollywood in his speeches. He was close with a guy named John Flynn, who I just mentioned, who was a journalist. He had written for Collier's and the New Republic. He was very much a Washington insider. He was also chairman of the New York America First Committee. And these two really schemed to get financing secured for the investigation. And one of the other things that happened in this like summer leading up to the investigation, while they're trying to justify looking into Hollywood, there are two very important events that happen at the Hollywood Bowl in Los Angeles. So June 20th, there was an America First rally at the Hollywood Bowl. And Lindbergh was there, and Senator D. Worth Clark was there speaking, and it was a packed house, but it wasn't really a star-studded event, but it was a packed house, and it showed in Hollywood that, look, there is a lot of isolationist support still here in Los Angeles around you, but a little over a month later, in July, there was an interventionist rally, and this was a star-studded event. And all of Hollywood came out for it. It was also a packed house. It was interesting, though, how the isolationists would sell the event in the press. They would say, oh, well, we had our rally and it packed. You know, it was a sellout. And then they had their rally and nobody came.
Although, well, that sounds interesting. Sounds right, somewhat familiar.
Right. Exactly. That's not relevant today. But in truth, the isolationist rally did sell out and the interventionist rally did not, but it almost sold out. So it was still very similar attendance. And again, this was happening right in Hollywood, right in Los Angeles, in the summer before this investigation. And it really, I think, irked Hollywood, the studios, having this kind of rally right in their backyard. And then, of course, you have of all the America First rallies, there's lots of talk of, or at least in a lot of them, Hollywood, issues with Hollywood and the movies that they were making.
Obviously, as you say in the book, it's a combination of journalists and senators. Who actually starts it? Is the journalists first? I mean, are they the ones that begin to push about it?
Some
journalists.
When do
the senators start to get involved?
So it's a really weird organization. So Gerald Nye and John Flynn are kind of scheming to get this the funding secured for this and trying to convince other people in the Senate to look at Hollywood. And it's interesting because even during the investigation, Gerald Nye never mentions, he always talks about the Hollywood insiders that he knows and that he's going to use, but he never mentions who they were. He just assures everybody that they're trustworthy. But where they end up putting this investigation, and it's weird because it's technically not an investigation. It's an inquiry to see if there should be an investigation. So there's really weird language. And it ends up getting proposed to the Interstate Commerce Committee, which was run by Burton Wheeler out of Montana. He's a senator from Montana. And so this was a subcommittee of the Interstate Commerce Committee. And one of the reasons it got into there is that in addition to the propaganda, they added an amendment where this will also look at Hollywood and potential monopolistic practices. Of course, by 1948, they actually get in trouble for that, but it's already being proposed and looked at. So it gets into the Interstate Commerce Committee, and then Wheeler has Senator D. Worth Clark of Idaho put together a subcommittee, and he puts together a group, a very interesting group. It's a bipartisan group. You got Democrats and Republicans in there. So you have Wheeler, who was a Democrat. You have Clark, Worth Clark. There's two Clarks, so that was kind of tricky. There's Worth Clark, who's a Democrat from Idaho. Then you have Gerald Nye, who I mentioned, who's a Republican from North Dakota. And interestingly, his background is actually in journalism as well. So you almost wonder if before he got into politics, if he got a taste of the yellow journalist kind of thing. Then we have Bennett Champ Clark, who's a Democrat from Missouri, Charles Toby, Republican from New Hampshire, Wyland Brooks, who's a Republican from Illinois, Ernest McFarland, Democrat from Arizona. And then there was somebody else that was supposed to be on the subcommittee, Homer T. Bone, who was a Democrat from Washington, but he got sick and he wasn't able to attend. But what's interesting is that what they thought they were putting together was this group of isolationists. And they threw, you know, probably the worst thing that they could have done, and they would never have seen it coming, is they put Ernest McFarland on this committee. And he ultimately becomes the hero of this whole thing in a sense, because he is a junior senator at the time. He hasn't been overly vocal about a lot in the Senate anyway. He was was a lawyer in Arizona and very well known in Arizona already, would later then become governor of Arizona, I think more than once. But he is the one who would ask all the questions that would really unravel this entire thing. He came in very honestly and asked questions that should have been easy to answer throughout the inquiry, but they couldn't do it and ended up becoming this wild card that they did not expect. And you know, the lawyer in him ended up asking all the right questions, which is interesting because subcommittee, is that I mentioned before how Wendell Willkie was Hollywood's counsel. They actually gagged him. They actually said, you cannot cross-examine anybody we bring in here. You can be here, you can object. So what he ended up doing, which was maybe even better, was that he, you know, since he couldn't speak during the actual examinations and testimonies, is he would give full long interviews to the press every day so that the whole country could get his side.
One of the things that's worth mentioning, and you've talked about it, is that congressional committees are not the same as courts of law. They
right.
can pretty much set their own rules. If they don't want somebody to speak, they can say they can't speak. I mean, theoretically, only the senators, but and staff, and so somebody like a Willkie or someone else who might be object to the issues really doesn't have the opportunity to say anything. And if they wanted to testify before the committee, it's up to the committee to decide whether they're going to allow it or not.
Right.
And of course, you mentioned that briefly. I want to just add a little context that the monopoly issue, because that became at least part of the justification for all this. And of course, the monopoly issue is that the studios were getting into trouble because they also owned the theaters that were
right.
showing their films. And that became a major issue almost immediately with Hollywood. And of course, as you pointed out, until they finally had to divest themselves, it was always a big thing that got brought up when people talked about Hollywood.
Yeah, and it's interesting because there are entire days of this investigation that get lost into the monopoly discussion. And that's one of the things that frustrates Ernest McFarland, because he's like, so where's the propaganda? I'm not seeing it. But one of the people they actually subpoena is Nicholas Skenk. So he's president of Lowe's, who owns MGM. And they're trying to throw numbers at him about and they do this with other people as well, about the, you know, owning the theaters and all this kind of stuff. And they don't, MGM has not a lot of theaters. It's Paramount that has the huge number of theaters. And he does a really good job of actually showing how, because one of the big arguments with the monopoly is that you're not creating competition. And he's like, there's plenty of competition because most of us don't own a lot of theaters. There's actually just some of us that have a lot of theaters, and the studios that didn't have a ton of theaters, they just had a very different way of marketing their movies, that they didn't see it necessarily as a problem that Paramount had so many and some of the other ones had less. But he actually gave some really good examples about how the studios still also work together and they don't, because there was talks of how, you know, the studios had every, you know, every had such control over their talent as well, which they did. But he made a really good example of studios lending out, you know, if there's somebody that they have under their contract and they and another studio came in with an offer that would benefit that studio, but it would also help the star power of whoever they have under contract, they would work together on allowing a studio to have, say, I think he used Clark Gable as an example, getting loaned out for It Happened One Night. And they knew that was a great project.
Clark Gable was all over the place. So that's...
Right, exactly. So they used that as an example, like, hey, this is going to be a great film. It's going to be great for that studio, but it's also going to be great for the studio that has his primary contract. So, you know, they're helping each other out and competing at the same time, because you're loaning him out to a competing studio that's going to help them. But you also see that it's going to help, you know, whoever owns his contract in the long run. But that entire day, they actually brought, they used Skank for an entire day, and then they brought him back the next day. And that was one of the days where it was really clear how little that the senators knew about how Hollywood operated. It was basically a Q&A session. And they talked very little about propaganda. and by then it was already starting to unravel. But I mean, that was a day that, particularly in the press, that it was very clear that the senators were over their head.
So we talk about this as being an investigation. Was there much more than the actual hearings going on, or obviously hearings tend to be the middle, you know, the most obvious, well-known part of any kind of investigation, but was there a real investigation going on, or was this more of a matter of we wanted these hearings so we could be out in the public with this?
It was very much that. It was very much hearings to be out in the public. There really wasn't anything beyond this going on, because really, I mean, the other thing that was happening that was supposed to be controlling movies was, you know, the censorship body in Hollywood. So that was already in place. So they didn't need to. And that's one of the things that's interesting. They didn't bring in Will Hayes. They didn't bring in Joseph Breen, who they really should have. It probably could have. I mean, there's a lot of people that they talked about bringing in and never did. We mentioned Chaplin earlier. They had actually said in the press, we're bringing in Chaplin. And I so wish they did, because that there would have been so much fireworks if they would have went up against Chaplin. But they also talked about bringing in Billy Wilkerson, who was running the Hollywood Reporter. And he is somebody who really hated the studios. So that also would have been interesting. But it really wasn't, it didn't really get that deep. It was really just, in a sense, a show trial, not even a real trial, but to take the title from Tom Doherty's last book. But it was for show. And that comes out, you know, it comes out when Bennett Champ Clark testifies. He makes it very clear that radio and movies should not be able to reach a larger audience than elected officials. He thought that was unfair. He said, they don't speak for the people, we speak for the people. So at that point, it was very clear that you could just sense the jealousy, that he didn't feel, they were annoyed that they weren't featured on newsreels as much, and they didn't get the attention that the stars did and the studios did and the movies did. So they felt that they were being overrun by people who did not deserve to have the platform that they had.
Once again, we see this not just with Hollywood nowadays, but also with people like sports figures now, who are basically mm-hmm. being told to stick to sports or stick to, you know, anytime someone talks about something that's considered political or controversial, they're being told to stick to your own lane and stay away from this. And yet, so once again, it's another example of where things have not changed. So how long did the actual hearings last?
Not very long. They started on September 9th. And then they would go a few days at a time. The last day was September 26th. And it was really unraveling quickly by then. What's interesting is that, so they did one recess in here after September 15th, and then they come back, and then at the end of the month they take another recess. And the intention was to come back and continue hearing. And this is maybe when they thought they were going to bring in Chaplin and Wilkerson and Hayes. But what's interesting, one of the big reasons for the recess was, so going back to the first day, so when Gerald Nye starts testifying and talking about how dangerous these movies are and making his wild claims about the Mortal Storm being co-opted by British propagandists and all this kind of stuff, and talking about how, I mean, leading up to that day in the press, he had talked about these movies are making America punch drunk with propaganda and they're going to push her into war and all this kind of stuff. I mentioned Ernest McFarlane earlier. He very honestly asked Nye, he's like, look, I'm not a movie guy. So, you know, we go to the movies a couple times a year. I don't know a lot about them. Can you explain to me a little bit more about what makes these movies so dangerous? What makes them propagandistic? And he couldn't answer. And he starts pressing him. He's like, all right, well, look, what about the, you mentioned this movie. What about this one? What about this one? What about this one? And he's like, I don't know if I've seen it. I don't know if I've seen it. So it didn't take really long before we realized that he hasn't seen any of them. And so this sets McFarlane on fire. He can't believe that they would even put together an investigation or a inquiry without even watching the movies. But this is where Nye would come back and say, well, I've heard about how bad they are from trusted people. Just trust me. So one of the reasons for the recess going back to the end of September is McFarlane keeps saying, can we watch these movies? Can we actually look and see if this is even worth being talked about? So there's all this promise of watching the movies. And of course that never happens. And, you know, of course Pearl Harbor happens. And even after, you know, even right before Pearl Harbor and right after, the senators are planning on bringing this back together, but it isn't until later in the month, about a week or week and a half after Pearl Harbor, they finally formally close the investigation. But it's wild.
So obviously, as I mentioned earlier, because of when it took place, you could see how things would be different after Pearl Harbor, and continuing something like this would be pretty much a waste of time. We talk about the anti-Semitism as far as the America First movement and the isolationist movement. Are there aspects during the hearings where anti-Semitism reared its ugly head?
It's what it's mostly in the form of is talking about, you know, they usually don't, you know, it's not as outward as we might think, but it was pretty outward for the time in the sense that they're talking about talking about all of the filmmakers and the studio bosses as immigrants who brought their problems over here, they should deal with them, go back home. You know, so it's really the xenophobia, but it so happens that all of the people they point out and a lot of the people they mention in Hollywood as problematic are Jewish. So that's something that's something that becomes so clear that when Daryl Zanuck is brought in, he assures the committee that they have nothing to worry about because he was born in the United States, which of course creates a bunch of laughter because by this point it's pretty clear that to everybody following that this has this very, very shallow underneath the surface thread of anti-Semitism, so much too that when you look at the reporting, a lot of the, there's the dogs.
That's okay.
It's fine. So much so when you look at a lot of the reporting, they talk about how when certain people were mentioned that they could hear the senators or maybe the supporters of the investigation in the crowd always mentioning, oh, that person's Jewish. That person's Jewish. So there was a lot of nodding to that, and then, of course, the studio, like I said, the studios they went after. I mean, it's really no surprise that they brought in Harry Warner, but that was another really big mistake. I mean, Harry Warner, out of all of the studio moguls, was probably the most proud of his heritage of being Jewish and the last person to ever hide it. And he actually, the biggest nail in the coffin of this entire investigation is when Harry Warner comes up, not only does he give a lengthy statement where he is not to be interrupted about how his family came to the United States and everything that they went through to create their studios. But once he starts talking about the anti-Nazi movies, he reads a wire that was sent from Gerald Nye to the studio after watching Confessions of a Nazi Spy in 39 and talking about how amazing he thought the film was and all this kind of stuff. And it really, it was fun reading the press coverage there because it says that, you know, Nye, his face just turned red. And it's now, you know, this guy that has been the most animated and the most vocally anti-Hollywood and anti-propaganda movies had actually told Warner Brothers how awesome Confessions of a Nazi Spy was.
Speaking of which, what kind of coverage did these hearings get in the mainstream press?
Well, and that's a great question, because that's one of the reasons I decided to write the book, was that I realized that this was really anybody following the news in September of 1941 knew that this was going on. So much so that during the first recess, they actually had asked FDR about it. And he kind of laughed the investigation off, like not even taking it seriously. But it was covered in a lot of the major newspapers. It wasn't just the Hollywood Trade Press, but even the trade press coverage was syndicated across tons of newspapers around the whole country, big and small. That actually reminds me, I mean, going back to the anti-Semitism angle, there was one other big thing that I found. So one of the places I researched was the National Archives, the Senate Archives in DC. And I had found when I went out there, the archivist said, yeah, we have like 1,000 pages on this. The bad news is it's all unorganized, but the good news is that means nobody has looked at this since 1941. And one of the things I found were a lot of the letters of support to the senators. And almost all of these letters were anti-Semitic. They were all like, thank you for finally going after the Jews in Hollywood. And that it was that kind of thing where that's when it became really clear that the people that really, you know, the real intentions here were seen by a lot of people. And there was whole fold. And the fact that the senators kept those letters and didn't just toss them is also kind of telling. I talk about some of the letters in the book, but there's a lot of pretty ugly stuff that came through in that mail.
So was the news coverage, were some newspapers covering it as a pro or against? I mean, I know especially people don't always know this, but newspapers definitely had slants.
Yep.
And were there groups of reporters? Obviously, we talked about the reporters being some of the catalyst for this, but were pro and anti investigation reporters in force here?
Yeah, almost the entire coverage was against the investigation. And that's not just the Hollywood press. But of course, you know, all the Hollywood press was against except for Jimmy Fidler. But it's interesting because the ones that were for the investigation were really obvious. So, for example, we mentioned Father Coughlin earlier, and he had a publication called Social Justice.
Right.
And that publication was very much for the investigation and very much against Hollywood. Really no surprise there. So it was those kinds of publications that were pretty obvious. There was some of the Hearst Press, one of the San Francisco papers had an issue, but that was more of an issue with one of the critics. But for the most part, it was people saw the investigation as silly. And a big part of that is because Hollywood, you know, the movies that they're talking about, and John Flynn is the only one who really creates a list of these movies that I published in the book. It's not a lot of movies, and, you know, a handful or so from each studio, some international films, and it's a tiny percentage of the output of any studio in any given year. So it was really easy to see this as not a big deal. And also, not all these movies did well. Some of them did, but not all of them. They weren't all unanimously box office smashes either. So it seemed a really weird thing to worry about. And a lot of people in the press saw that. And one of the things that the Film Daily did is they sent out a poll to, I think, A bunch of critics. I know they got, I was just looking at the numbers yesterday. They got 113 responses back. And all of the critics from all over the country were 100% against the investigation. And they did not see these movies as dangerous. So that was something that was a pretty big deal as well, because that wasn't just the Hollywood press. Those were journalists and critics from all over the country that could very easily see that this was a really useless investigation.
And unfortunately, this would not be, wasn't the first time and wouldn't be the last time that that Congress and congressional investigations would go against Hollywood. Of course, the next time, major time, is for, once again, propaganda films. But in this case, it would be the ones that were pro-Russia or mm-hmm. pro-Soviet Union during World War II. Those become topics for hearings. And then, of course, as we get into the 40s and 50s, and things get worse and worse and worse. So it's clear that Senate and other groups, political groups, have figured out that the way to get good, to get press, whether it's good or bad, mm-hmm. is to investigate Hollywood.
Yeah, and there's a long trend to this. Like you said, it wasn't the first, it wasn't the last. One of the things I mentioned in my conclusion is that there's a long history, really, from the beginning of Hollywood and really to today throughout all of popular culture, for either politicians or certain lobbyist groups and special interest groups to deem certain pieces of popular culture as dangerous. And sometimes throughout history, this leads to investigations and hearings. And it happened with comic books in the 1950s. Right. And it happened with movies again in the 1950s, music in the 80s, video games in the 90s. I mean, we see this, this is an interesting piece of, this book is an interesting piece, slice of history, but is one piece of a much larger trend of really a fear of popular culture.
Right. Especially when it becomes nationwide, like with, as you say, like with radio, and then eventually, like even newspapers were local, even though they might pick up stories from state area mm-hmm. to area, they still were essentially local. And yet things like radio and then movies and then television and then the internet, so on and so forth, suddenly gets out of locality and mass media, the real concept of mass media really comes into effect.
Right.
So, obviously, this book, your main clear, obviously, you're showing that, number one, the issues related to anti-Semitism in Hollywood were already deeply ingrained, even by this point, at Hollywood, not in Hollywood. And then also the issues related to Congress and other organizations feeling the need to somehow control or have some control over what Hollywood does. What would you consider to be the most important outcome of these hearings and what you feel they showed the most?
One of the things that I think I had in my mind kind of building the whole time I was reading through the congressional record was the similarities between the people that were pushing hardest against these movies seemed to know the least about them. And I think that is a thread that we've seen, in this country for 100 years with popular culture. And it's one of the things I mentioned in my conclusion, that this type of pushback against popular culture is so common, and it catches, especially now in the social media era, it catches and moves so quickly that makes it even more important to really take a lot of it with a grain of salt. And, it's important to always understand the context around what you're looking at, what you're watching, the history of it, the interpretations of it, and do the research yourself. Make sure you look into it. If there's a movie that's getting a lot of negative press, maybe take a look at it. Don't be the Gerald Nye in going after a certain movie and just hearing how bad it was. Go watch it. And the historical context as well, right? There's a lot of talk recently about Gone with the Wind, but also going back to something like Birth of a Nation. These movies are, of course, very racist, but also very important for other reasons, artistic. But these movies were also protested when they came out. There was pushback. The contemporaries of this era, of these eras, pushed back against these movies as well. It's not a new thing. So I think it's always important to learn the context and understand the time period, and learn that some things have changed since certain movies have come out, and some things have not. And I think one of the things that has not, that I think we need to work on as a culture, is informing the people like Gerald Nye that, you know, there's one movie isn't going to, undo the fabric of society, especially if it wasn't a totally popular one.
Yeah, and speaking of Birth of the Nation, I just had an interview not that long ago with Greg Garrett about his book A Long, Long Way, Hollywood's Unfinished Journey from Racism to Reconciliation. And we start with Birth of a Nation, and he doesn't talk much about Gone with the Wind in that book, but it's still a concept that these films and other popular works deserve to at least be reviewed and looked at so that we learn from them, as opposed to just saying, you know, how bad they are. We need to understand better why they're so bad and what we can learn from them.
Definitely.
So you said you were working on another book. I think you said back to Warner Brothers again, but
yes.
I don't want to have you spoil secrets, but where are we with future work?
I haven't talked about it a lot, but it's not really an overt secret either. I am working on what I was planning on was a follow-up to my first book about Warner Brothers, which was much more focused on the films and how they interacted with society in the earlier years, basically the Depression up to World War II. What I ended up doing as I was doing a follow-up to that and, deviated to the Hollywood Hates Hitler book. And now what I've ended up doing is going to be a biography of the Warner Brothers. So, we've had some books about the Warner Brothers in the 70s and 80s that were much more kind of not deeply researched. We have the family biography, but we don't have, particularly with a lot of new archival access, there is a lot of stuff about the family and about their journey that really hasn't been talked about. So I'm writing a biography of the Warner Brothers, still not sure what the title will be yet, but planning on having that out in 2023, which will be the centennial of the studio.
Yeah, that's one of the things I talk about regularly with authors about their various books, is how now we're in a golden age of archives.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that even so many of them are even digitized, where you can do a great deal of research without having to go anyplace. But you also still have to get out there and look at the right material. But it's just great how archives are making the works of yours and other similar authors possible, because you can get to these things, particularly when we're talking about older periods of time where things like interviews are just not something you can do.
Definitely. Yeah, there's a lot of old Hollywood trade press that has been digitized, like you said. And, there's still a lot in the archives that needs to be written about. But I think that, like you said, the digitization has made it really easy. And a lot of archives might have stuff digitized that you don't know. And, I've reached out to archives and they've sent me stuff. I think the internet age has made, I'm really glad that I kind of came of age in my career and became a professor as this stuff was all coming to be, because it makes it, the research community is so much more connected now than I think it once was. And it makes this not necessarily easy, but things that you can do, that you don't necessarily need to get like university approval and travel and all this kind of stuff to go somewhere and do, you can always be working on your research. And there is a lot of interviews and stories and things like that that haven't been written about yet, that add interesting context. I just got done writing about like the late teen, leading up to incorporation of Warner Brothers. And there's so much stuff in the old trade press and photos of their old offices and things like that that I have never seen anywhere. So it's really exciting.
Well, there's one of the positives of social media, too. It means you can reach out to somebody on the other side of the world who might have like interest or might have information, and you can throw ideas off the wall and things like that together without having to worry about having to be on the telephone or letters. Oh, my exactly. God, letters. Having to write letters.
Actual handwriting. So,
well, I really appreciate your time. Hollywood Hates Hitler. The book is a great look at another period of time where Congress and other organizations decide to go after Hollywood. The book is great, and I hope people reach out and review it carefully and read and learn the lessons from it.
Definitely. Yeah, thank you very much for having me, Joel. I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. Thanks to Chris for his great discussion of his book and his research. This is Joel Cherney, and I will be back soon with more New Books in Film, a podcast series on the New Books Network.